Hey, listen, thank you all for being here this evening. Wow, I didn't see how people can talk about the Reformation after a long day for work.
Things on it, cleanse.
But you all look so clean.
I got the water on, so
for a change.
Chance to shower.
Oh, yeah, I see. Wasn't that great? Get a water bath.
Yes.
Warm. And the first, I'll just say a few words and then talk. But the first time we talked about, of course, that Luther that nobody knows. And if anybody's interested in the book, there you go. It is, it will selling like hotcakes throughout the church. I got one more to my name. But this is the book.
You didn't bring a box of them?
I should have. I ordered a box of books, but they didn't arrive. I was going to bring up all the books, but they didn't make it.
Well, it doesn't be available at the bookstore.
Well, I think we get it in the bookstore. Maybe if we can order them in the next period for people coming up here, because this is the type of a theme that you have to study, have to look at it, go into the history, and then ask, of course, what does this mean for today? Which sort of brings us to this evening. Let me start from the fact of this rather intriguing Pope we have now, Pope Francis. Isn't he something special?
Yeah.
I mean, Bishop Medardo Gomez of the Lutheran Church of El Salvador, he says, this Pope is a Lutheran. And that is his line. And of course, you know, just like the Lutherans of El Salvador and Guatemala, they have come through the horrible struggle against the terrible oppressive governments. And they've been carried on the wings of liberation theology, if you will. It's the Second Vatican Council of Pope John the 23rd. You know, this was back in the 50s, 1956 or something like that. But it set in motion something so dynamic, you know, that President Reagan had to call the CIA to set up special meetings about what this means. And it got to be a huge, huge thing. People who were participating in it, as I said yesterday, many of them the women leaders of the church, Catholic and Lutheran and otherwise, many lost their lives. The great poet of Guatemala, Julia Esquivel, said, you know, we had to bury the catechism and the Bible in the soil so that the bayonets of the soldiers would not find them. Well, this period that they call La Violencia was a terrible time for the church, but it brought out the very best of the church. And I think it is, of course, what created Pope Francis. He emerged from this time, as did so many of the great Lutheran and other Presbyterian and other leaders of Central America. It was an ecumenical thing. You know, one thing also created by Pope John XXIII was the Lutheran Roman Catholic Dialogues, celebrated 50 years ago at the Roman Catholic University in Washington, D.C. People came from the Vatican, people came from our Elizabeth Eaton and the Lutheran Church, all the bishops came, and it was a celebration of 50 years of Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue. That was partly, mainly, biblical, theological, that has produced this unbelievable document the joint declaration on the doctrine of justification. If you went to your Google and just entered JDDJ, it would just pop up. That rather amazing document, signed in 1999, that was the result of 50 years of Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue. And the gist of it is, of course, that the Catholic Church said, on the very item that divided the church, we have no disagreement whatsoever with Lutherans. Absolutely no. We have the very same teaching on justification by grace through faith. And you read that document, JDDJ, and you will see that, that Lutherans and Roman Catholics say the very same thing about what Luther was talking about at the time of the Reformation. Therefore, all these articles are coming out now in the Roman Catholic world about the Reformation being over. Why are we separate churches anymore? And on the Lutheran side also. Except, of course, the Missouri Synod said it's a total fraud. That was the quote from the Missouri Synod leadership. But if you read that document, you find, wow, this is just unbelievable. What at the very heart of it, is there any disagreement anymore with Pope Francis? Let me mention this as a sort of aside, and then I'll go back to Martin. But along with these theological debates that have taken place, and I have been privileged to be a participant in that, I won't say I'm one of the heavy-duty theologians and biblical scholars, but I've been allowed to be part of that discussion since the organization that I was in charge of was responsible for the Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogues. And I tell you, at different places along the way, you could see these breakthroughs when you discovered that some of the language used in those early condemnations was language rooted in a type of understanding of the world that we're not familiar with today. You cleared away all this brush, and then you found these common things. Of course, the condemnations that came at the Council of Trent after the Reformation, some of those still remain. But this unbelievable feat. And I could tell example after example of when Avery Dulles, great Catholic theologian and cardinal of the church, said something to the Lutheran side. He said, you know, that is what we have been saying in other words. And then from the Lutheran side, John Ruman would say, thank you, Brother Dulles. I guess Avery Dulles just died recently, but he was one of the great Roman Catholic theologians, the son of John Foster Dulles, by the way. But as we went through this unbelievably exciting period for these years, something else happened. We discovered that we had a common ministry in Central America. We had a common ministry. And, you know, it's probably the biggest thing that ever happened in my life, you know, getting to know some people involved in the internal armed struggle in Guatemala, getting to know them in Europe mainly and then in other places. But with the guerrilla leaders, we'd sometimes, they were just labeled as Marxist guerrillas and written off. They were doctors, priests. They were journalists, wonderful people, and we would meet sometimes in the bars of Geneva in Switzerland and talk into the night about why has this war now taken 200,000 lives and people being not just executed, people being tortured to death. Lutheran pastors, how many? How many were just taken and disappeared? Lay catechists of the Roman Catholic Church. And then it was possible to say to the Catholics, can we ask Pope John Paul II to intervene and to help us? And he said, and they said yes. Our friends in the Vatican, the Secretariat for Promoting Christian Unity, that was sort of our avenue into all of the Vatican apparatus. And I remember the day, and I'll make this very short, or I could make it a lot longer, that I presented to John Paul II. I said, this is the situation in Guatemala, and would you all work with us to see if we can't bring peace to this country? Well, he summoned the Secretary of State, Cardinal Silvestrini, in charge of political matters, and they conferred, we met again, and John Paul II said, yes, this we will work together. They knew everything that was happening in Guatemala and the violence and all the priests and catechists they had lost. Well, the short story is that we started talking. Lutheran World Federation that I represented to the guerrilla movements, four guerrilla movements, we got them all together. And through John Paul II's intervention, and through the papal nuncio in Guatemala City, we had access to the Holy Episcopal Conference, all the Roman Catholic bishops of Guatemala, and we met in a number of places and devised a strategy. I was able to speak to the Minister of Defense of Guatemala. Who's some Lutheran pastor coming into Guatemala, where you can hardly find a Lutheran, to try to talk to the Minister of Defense. But thanks to John Paul II, you know, right there, not only the Minister of Defense and his aide, but then in the afternoon, most of the high command of the Guatemalan military. And I remember this brutal dictator looking at me and says, why in the world should we want to have a negotiation with these guerrillas? And of course, and you say, well, you're losing so many generals. You're losing so many men in the field. You're killing all these civilians. All the deaths, 94%. At the hands of the military, 6% at the hands of the guerrillas in 26 years. Anyway, the short story is this, that the Minister of Defense said, okay, we will meet. And we had a place to meet in Sweden, Stockholm, although the word got out a little too soon. A lot of people don't want peace, of course. And Swedish embassy was attacked, and the ambassador had to flee to Costa Rica. One guard at the embassy was killed. Anyway, we changed it to Norway, and up in the Holmenkollen Mountains in a chalet, I remember the night at the airport waiting to see if any of these people would show up, the guerrilla movement leaders. You know, very risky business. And, you know, you thought half the Norwegian military was out there just to make sure nothing bad happened. Anyway, after a week of tough work, we've fashioned an agreement. And it came about through a very strange way. I won't go into it, but on the very last day, hammered out an agreement that finally lasted. I mean, when the document was signed on that last day in the morning, the American ambassador came, Prime Minister of Norway came to this little chalet up in the Holmenkollen Mountains outside of Oslo. So it got to be a really big deal. But when the United Nations stepped in then, this was an assurance that something was going to happen with respect to demilitarization of this country. I mean, we had a number of other meetings on the economy in Quito, Ecuador, one in El Escorial in Spain, another one in Ottawa in Canada, and one in Mexico. But it finally came down to a signing of the peace agreement, the end of the war. And when it happened, all these thousands of people flooded Guatemala City, and it was just a huge festival. And the peace then held, based on what they call the Oslo Agreement. My point here is not to say that this, it's only to say that what has happened in these last 50 years has not only been a convergence on the theological, biblical understanding, the research of the historical documents of the Reformation, but of joining together in a common ministry in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Brazil, and in a number of places. And as I don't know if I mentioned it, but I'm out of email contact, but one of the people that fluent in Spanish who helped me with this was Philip Anderson, a Lutheran pastor. Total trust of indigenous people, the Mayan Indians in Guatemala. Unbelievable. Now he's in hospice care in Minneapolis, and I think he only has days to live. Very, very tough time, and he's about 20 years younger than I am. So anyway, I'm just going into this topic somewhat backward to say that we have come to this convergence now. And the question is, what do you do with this? The very reason for being of the Reformation seems to have evaporated before our eyes. Even this little book that we created here in these last couple of months, some of those people on the study group were Roman Catholics in Northern Virginia. And they are having study groups now to also deal with Martin Luther. The St. Francis has said, his first exhortation when he became Pope, apostolic exhortation, didn't rank quite with encyclical, but he wrote, I hope I brought it with me, unbelievable statement about how the great evil before us today is the great income disparity. The disparity in wealth. I mean, coming out of Argentina, I mean, he came to the United States. I mean, he knew that 49 million Americans are hungry at night. He knows that of the Earth's 6 billion population, a third of them can't read or write. He knows UNICEF statistics that say 22,000 children die every single day because of hunger. In this encyclical, Apostolic Exhortation of 2013, the first he did, he said something about it is the church must be called to deal with the structural causes of inequity, the structural causes of poverty. Now, when he's speaking that way, who would you think of? That's Pope Francis. He's making this statement that I've got in my room, but it's such a beautiful statement, and it just jumped at me from off the page. It sounds just like
Martin Luther.
Martin Luther! And that other fellow, whose name is? No?
Karl Marx.
No. Karl Marx! No. Wow. You know, you can't blame the sins of communism on Karl Marx. Karl Marx, although it comes from a family of rabbis, but his grandfather converted to Lutheranism early on. So Karl grew up in the Lutheran Church of the Rhineland and went to confirmation. Read his confirmation papers. Already aware of people being alienated in the Industrial Revolution of his day, condemning of the church for only doing Band-Aid things. Why wasn't the church doing something? This is Karl Marx. Karl Marx, by the way, said that the first political economist in the history of Germany is Martin Luther. I was thinking of another person, more contemporary.
Bernie.
Oh. All right, Bernie. Don't say this too loudly. This isn't being recorded, is it? But it's saying the same thing that Bernie Sanders is saying, of course, today. You know, when the Pope came, Pope Francis came, a group of us from Northern Virginia, is a bit crazy, wrote a letter to him. And mentioning this exhortation. And the Papal Nuncio, Washington, D.C., persuaded by a couple of theologians at the Roman Catholic University in D.C., said, yes, we will take that and hand it to him. So we did that all up. Everybody signed it, Lutherans, Catholics, Presbyterian. Lauren Mead, if anybody knows, is a great church writer from the Episcopal Church, Episcopal Bishop, that we had all been studying together, and we all signed it and handed him the letter. And it was basically welcoming him to the United States and asking if we could not ecumenically, and if he would not initiate a study and learning process that would in fact deal with the structural causes of hunger and poverty and so forth. Well, you don't know how far that got, whether he actually read it. I was assured by a good friend that he did get it in his hand, but you don't know where that leads. You trust in the Holy Spirit's leaning because you know that there might be something more, no more critical in our society than this issue. In our community where I live or I lived, hungry people, kids, Hispanics, black, especially poor people. People who come home from McDonald's and work at the minimum wage, it's not enough. So they go hungry. And we can make all our slogans of this about 1%, but the fact is, you've got the accumulation of wealth in 1%, and a lot of people going hungry. It is not enough, going back to Luther, to give food out. You have a food pantry at your church. I mean, Luther and Katie, they were really the softest touch. People lined up to get food at their house. So it's not knocking that ministry. It's saying that that is not what is required in our day. It's like, again, Helder Camara, the bishop of the Church of Recife, said, and I repeat it once more, that there is, when I give food to the hungry, people say I'm a saint. When I ask them, why are these people hungry, they call me a communist. The question is, are we willing to tackle the causes? And they, of course, lie within the economic system. It's difficult. When we had our symposium in November 2015 in Washington, D.C., they came from the World Bank, they came from Capitol Hill, experts on the economy. So the discussion wasn't, pie in the sky. Because these people at the World Bank, so committed to eradicate poverty and hunger from the world, you know, they are just wonderful, wonderful people. You can disagree economically, politically, it doesn't matter. But there has to be a point at which we say, can we work? Luther says, this is what the gospel demands of us. There's no direct line from the Bible to any particular system of economy or politics or anything. That would be to confuse the gospel with the law. Luther was totally against that. But he says, listen, love God and serve your neighbor. The liturgy after the liturgy. When service is over, service begins. And what Luther did, of course, was absolutely revolutionary. There's no reason to doubt what Karl Marx has written. We don't say that too loudly, that Karl Marx said that, because Karl Marx has such a bad reputation. But let me go back to Luther very quickly. In the year 1530, Luther gathered his friends in his room in the Lutherstube. Maybe you've been there in Wittenberg. He gathered Lukas Cranach and his wife, Barbara, Philip Melanchthon and his wife, Katharina, his own wife, of course, Katie, who was the economist. He gathered a few other people, Johannes Bugenhagen, his confessor, pastor of the town church. And 1530, this is the key, this is the beginning of the Lutheran church. Because Philip Melanchthon is going to go to Augsburg later in the year, read the Confessio Augustana, the Augsburg Confession, to the Emperor, Charles V. This was, and as we've said before, the concern here wasn't just the unity of the church, but the unity of the empire. Charles V came to Augsburg, but he knew that all around the Muslim armies were circling in on Europe. They had already taken the Holy Land, much of northern part of Africa. They'd taken most of France and Italy and Greece, and the Muslim armies were now circling around to Vienna, led by Suleiman the Magnificent. So when the Augsburg Confession comes to be written, it's not just an interesting theological argument. It has to do with the unity of the church, which holds the key for the unity of the empire. As I said, Suleiman wrote a letter to Martin Luther and said, listen, you and I, we could bring our forces together against Charles of the Holy Roman Empire. And he gave, that paper was delivered to Martin Luther, who had, of course, the Lutheran princes and all these armies behind him. And Luther wrote back a really wild letter. He says, don't you come to me. You might save me from Charles V, but who's going to save me from you? You know, and he just... that was the end of that. But that was the political situation in which this meeting in Augsburg took place. Luther couldn't go. He was an outlaw, excommunicated, condemned. Anybody who killed Martin Luther could do so with impunity. He gathers his friends, and he says to them a number of things, one of which, I think I do have a quote, where Luther, he realizes there's coming a movement, and some of their enemies have even started calling them Lutherans. And Luther is incensed by this. He wants no part of it whatsoever. And he writes, I ask that no one use my name in this way. Let people call themselves Christians, not Lutherans. Who is Luther anyway? These teachings are not mine. I was not crucified for anyone. St. Paul would not allow Christians to name themselves after Peter or Paul. How then could I, poor stinking scumbag that I am, the language is so harsh, that doesn't really translate it, have people call the children of God by my wretched name. Please, friends, let us do away with all such names and call ourselves Christians after the one whose teachings we hold. I mean, to the end of his life, Luther was so unhappy that anybody would name themselves after him. But then on this day in Wittenberg, they gather around and go over what they're going to present in Augsburg. And that presentation is something that most Lutheran congregations throughout the world ascribe to in their constitution. If you're a Lutheran, go and look in your constitution, it will say, we all believe in the unaltered Augsburg Confession. That is constitution for Lutherans throughout the world. But interestingly enough, if you read that document, you find it is just conciliatory. Luther, to think that they would form a separate church. You know, he has trouble at sleeping at night with this thought. The heart of the Augsburg Confession is its Article 7, which says about the unity of the church, it is sufficient for the true unity of the Christian church that the gospel be preached in conformity with a pure understanding of it, and that the sacraments be administered in accordance with the divine word. Period. That is it. And Luther said upon this sentence, this one sentence that I just read, the church rises or falls. Now, We're 500 years after that. And we all know how things have moved. Not in accordance with the wish of the reformers. Because the Augsburg Confession was, first of all, not accepted by the emperor. One could see that coming long before anybody got to Augsburg. But there was a hardening of the ways. Catholic theologians, then came the Inquisition, and then came the great wave of violence against the Lutheran Church. Then came the wars of religion, and we know what history has. Now, that's only the preamble to the question, where do we go from here? We've had a history of building up divergent ways. Through some saints along the way, we have found a little way back. I mean, when I was growing up in Detroit, Michigan, it was all neighborhood of Polish Catholics. You know, and man, to be a Lutheran in that mix, that wasn't always so pleasant. It could be pretty hard on you. So I mean, everybody has their own experiences. Some are bad and some are good. But as you look at the movement, you have to ask yourself anew the prayer of Jesus in John 17. Father, I pray that they all might be one, even as we are one, that the world might believe. And so my question tonight is, in light of all that's happened, divergence, but also convergence, unbelievable convergence, at the level of theology, Bible, mission, where does that put us? You know, Pope Francis is going to go to Lund, Sweden. He'll show up on Reformation Day this year. It's amazing. It's amazing. You all know what happened in Lund, Sweden. That's when, after the World War was over, in 1947, the Lutherans said, let's get together here. The Americans and the Germans especially. And they did come together. It was very tense. Still a couple people around who were at that meeting in 47. And the dramatic scene when Bishop Michael Felder, President Michael Felder of the Lutheran Church in the U.S., came to the microphone on one side, and the Bishop of Germany came on the other side. Every third Lutheran was a refugee in the world at this moment. Europe lay in ruins. Everybody just hated the Germans. And these two people come walking up to the microphone together. The great Hans Lilje and Michael Felder, both just great people. And they came and they embraced. You know, Germans don't embrace that easily. And this was a moment in history. Well, out of that, of course, was created the Lutheran World Federation. Then, of course, mainly churches in the North Atlantic, in Scandinavia, Canada, and the U.S. And now, of course, you go to the assembly next year in Windhoek, Namibia, and you will see among its 160 member churches, you will see representatives of some 80 million Lutherans worldwide unbelievable amount of color. Most come from Africa, Asia, Latin America. Now just a smattering from North Atlantic, Europe, and the United States. In 1947, so this year, Pope Francis goes to Lund, the birthplace of the Lutheran Communion. And I think it's very exciting. Still, the question remains, what form, if any, should the unity take? Probably Jesus in John 17 wasn't thinking of big global organizations. What does it mean that you might be one that the world might believe? What do you think? Where should we be going? Yeah?
I belong to a church that is both Lutheran and Catholic.
Uh-huh.
In Beaverton, Oregon, it's Mission of the Atonement. We have been together for 30 years and have basically just been waiting for the hierarchy to say we can commune together.
Oh, that's wonderful. That is wonderful. Now, do you have services together?
We have services together. We start out together in the sanctuary and have everything through the homily and the prayers of the faithful, and we even say the Lord's Prayer before we separate and then have Eucharist in different rooms.
Oh, yeah. Oh, dear. Oh, bless you guys. That is great. Waiting for the hierarchy to give us that.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's, and occasionally we do have Eucharist together. They have said for special occasions.
For special occasions. Don't tell.
Yeah,
no,
we do find special occasions.
That's beautiful.
To come back to God.
Yeah.
That's what they say. And I remember once in Central America at the church of Oscar Romero, who had been assassinated as he celebrated the Eucharist. His father, his successor, Riveri Damas, I was there, and I was there, and I brought seven or eight Lutheran bishops with me from Europe and from the U.S. And before the service on that Sunday, Riveri Damas, who took part in the consecration of the Lutheran bishop, by the way, in the laying on of hands, that is huge, he says, "Will you help me serve communion?" I mean, our little delegation freaked out. You know, especially the guy from Norway, Bishop Bjorn Bude, he just says, "What? I can't do that. I need the permission of mine." You know.
Yeah.
And it ended up all these bishops serve communion to all these campesinos coming in up into the great cathedral of San Salvador. And there was a moment that...
I guess I want to, because I think about it all the time, carry on a little bit with what I said last time. And everything that we're talking about within the tradition of agriculture, which is the tradition of creating surplus that we can store. And by its very nature, creating that surplus that we can store sets up the issue of who controls it. So in that first year, you were a better farmer than me, and in the middle of the winter, you loaned me something, so the next winter I owe you a few hours. We have 10,000 years of tradition saying that's actually a good thing to strive to store, and to strive to control. It's bootstrap theology of American theology, which is just sort of the end of the line for what we've seen in other countries that have done it. And it seems to me that Jesus might have come to say, you know what? Wasn't such a good track to go down. not necessarily the agriculture, but that our attention got focused on surplus and the control of surplus. We didn't have enough consciousness to remember grace. Grace versus works. What's works? You're going to earn it by the sweat of your brow. Works means I earned it. Grace, in the time before agriculture, is that this stuff comes always as a gift from nature. You never grow it. You always receive it from nature. So, I used to be a pastor in Nome, Alaska. Mm-hmm. I sat there, the population was 50-50. People from places like this, and 50% people who weren't Native. Mm-hmm. Sat there trying to think of one place on this planet where the intersection between Native and agriculture led to a result of a place becoming more Native. Never ever. Agriculture always wipes out Native way. Works have always wiped out this way that received directly from nature. And I never hear that as a conversation. Mm-hmm. It's a piece of why I left the church. Mm-hmm. I pray that the church will be quick enough to catch up to make some difference. But I guess I say this to you because you talk of all the places that you've been. It's only 10,000 years ago. And that legacy of living by grace, because you had to, because there was no other way, unless the game was there, you didn't get it. So now we live in a place with surplus, and we try to raise our consciousness. That seems to me to be the central issue. Now, how do you do that? Do you do that legally? You know, do you do it by Bernie Sanders approach or what? But it is the question of how do we have a consciousness now to live with surplus? And I never, ever hear this addressed.
Okay. No, that's very good. Thank you again for that. Thank you, because...
So, I told it to you because maybe you will.
But I ask, what are the implications of what you're saying for this question of church unity and Catholics and
My statement about the implications would be simply that all of the traditions that we're talking about are so inside of the tradition of agriculture that we're unaware of a system that preceded it for hundreds of thousands of years. And when we talk about law and gospel, I think people like Luther, people like Jesus, people like the Buddha, who came from a position of wealth and gave it up, are trying to remind us of a state of grace that we need to aspire to, but now we need to do it in this place where really we have this blessing of surplus, but what happens because we don't have enough consciousness is our energy gets sucked into it. Mm-hmm. And now I think I don't have enough. Who in America ever has enough? It doesn't matter how much we have, we don't have enough in general.
I think that if our goal is church unity, we're lost. I think our goal has to be the vision of the ministry, the very things you were describing. We come together because we see a need, and you so beautifully described that need. And if we focus on let's find a way to merge institutions when the validity of the institutions themselves is sometimes questionable, to me, that's not something to work for. To work for is the social justice. To work for exactly what you were just describing, to look at the foundations of that allow this inequity to exist. An example for me personally is I was thrilled to read the Francis's encyclical on global climate change.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And it was so beautifully written. And then I was so disappointed in the one section that declined to accept population control as a possible solution that we could be looking at. But I thought, well, if I'm going to throw out everything that's beautiful in that encyclical because I'm disappointed that he's refusing to look at that one issue, there's so much more we can work on together.
He's got a mafia around him, you know.
That's,
and he's going about as far as he can go. And John Paul is a prince, he's just the same way. He wanted to move way beyond what the Curia was allowing him to do. My wife and I had a meeting with him in Rome, and he, you know, I had all his theological things to do. I was going to try to impress the Pope. And he wanted to talk about our kids, her. You know, he didn't want to talk to me at all. And when the thing was all over, he gave her a rosary and shook my hand. But and now he's become a saint. You know, the rosary doesn't work really well. I mean, I took it to the Redskins game. Never mind. No, but it was this sort of wanting to get back to some very fundamental human things. It's just like in these theological debates, when we started talking about the Eucharist and Luther's understanding the finite is capable of bearing the infinite, then the Catholics said the finite is not capable of bearing the infinite. Then you both realize that you're dealing with an Aristotelian understanding of the world, and you're dealing with a Lutheran, more nominalistic, Wilhelm von Ockham, and you're both wanting to say the same thing. And at the end of that debate, you wanted like crazy to celebrate the Eucharist together. Mm-hmm. And of course, with this level, there was no way. It was happening. All you could do is have Johnny Walker Black after the meeting.
It's really a matter of traveling the distance from the head to the heart. The institutional church spends way too much time in the head and not enough time in the heart.
Well, in a sense, that's what you're saying also. That we have to get back to something more primordial in our life.
I think it's, of course it's that. Mm-hmm. But it's also that we don't even recognize that we live in an agriculturally based, surplus-driven frame of reference.
Yeah.
We're blind to that. So I think Luther and Jesus, the Buddha, they're actually addressing these things. Mm-hmm. But I think they too may have been so much in the box that they didn't even recognize that. Hmm. I certainly wouldn't have recognized it had I not lived in that place. Hmm. But I wanted to mention something else in terms of...
In what place? In Alaska?
In Alaska.
Okay, all right, good.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The other thing I wanted to mention is there's a gentleman whose name I can't even remember that I talked to quite a bit. He got his PhD in millennial studies, studies of the millennial generation. He said something very interesting to me. He said, some people are calling that generation the first, second oral culture. Second oral culture.
The second world culture.
The second, a second world oral culture. So the first oral culture
has gone.
Right?
The first oral culture is gone.
The first oral culture is native. And it's because of surplus, it's because of agriculture that we develop written language and mathematics to keep track of that stuff. We don't have it before that time. But the idea of it being a second oral culture, he said, because of social media, and my kids are in this generation, they're in college, but he says a lot of these people, and that he's not saying this in a disparaging way at all, but their purpose is not to go deep like your lecture has been full of history. It's to exist in the flow of things. Because there's so much information going by. And you've got younger people that, I don't really like this job. You know, it's really hard to keep millennials employed, and businesses are adapting to try to keep millennials employed, and people from a generation that studies deep like me, you know, would typically look at that as, oh, that's irresponsible. Mm-hmm. But this idea of a second oral culture mm-hmm. might have more in it about community, mm-hmm. might be actually an upsetting, might be why they were so impressed with Bernie Sanders.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, thank you for that. You know, it's interesting. I mean, Luther is a very oral person. I mean, at his town church where he preached, he did not want anybody to have a piece of paper. And this was the age of paper. It was coming streaming across the street from the Lucas Cranach Printing Company, as it does today. And you go into our churches and you get so many little pieces of paper, you know, that you're not quite... Luther would have none of that. You know, I used to preach in that church, also in the St. Mary's, the town church in Wittenberg. I mean, it was a great honor to preach there. But no bulletin, not reading a text. Listen, this is the Word. The Word is being spoken. Christ is addressing you. When Luther says, when the preacher preaches, God is speaking. Well, it's a little bit a stretch, but he said it, not me. But that was as much of the oral culture that Luther wanted to be part of. And he even mused sometimes that it might not have been the greatest thing that the Bible was written down. Luther, the Word alone, yes, but that doesn't mean the Bible alone, because the Word is Christ encountering you with word of judgment, with the word of grace, and this is more primordial, if you will. With my friend Philip Anderson, we used to be up in the mountains outside Guatemala City with Mayan Indians. And those worship services we had together, and the celebration of the sacrament together. I mean, most of them are indigenous Mayan, with some Catholic this stuff. But we found some place of communication together that was so beautiful. I will never forget those moments. I got to tell you this, I went to Turkey last year, and I went around all around Turkey. You know, that's where all the churches are. That's Galatia, Cappadocia, Thessalonica. I mean, all these people, the Antioch, all these cities of the Bible, that's Turkey, that's Asia Minor, Tarsus. I came to the town where Rumi, the poet, and the Whirling Dervishes started. It was a wonderful, and I asked the people leading the tour, all Muslims, of course, if I could go to the place where St. Paul and Barnabas came to Konya, they call it. In the Bible, it's Iconium. And it was late at night, and they said, sure. And I remember being taken by them to this a cave in the mountains. Inside this cave there was a fire. And they said, if you'd like to sit here for a while, go ahead. And I did. I sat by that fire in that cave looking out. And I asked myself, Paul and Barnabas, they came to Iconium, Acts 14. What did they have with them? Well, they didn't have cathedrals, churches, Bibles, hymnals. All they had was this gospel, this word of grace, of love, of healing, of redemption, of renewal. That's all I had. And in that moment, I mean, I just had one of those moments where you said, I mean, it might be that afterwards you learn. Let me put it this way. Only when you discover this essence of the gospel of Christ, then do you become free to start using whatever else you find as the sacraments of God's love to be shared with all people. But what did Paul bring around? He brought the message of Jesus Christ. And I don't know. I went through the Cathedral of Notre Dame with a Catholic scholar, and he leaned over to me and he said, he asked sort of rhetorically, "Do you think this is what Jesus had in mind?"
Oh, well.
And boy, I've never forgotten that moment. You know?
What prompted that question? Where'd that come from?
What, from him?
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, we had been having conversations before we got to this place, you know, about how these great cathedrals were built and who built them and what lives it cost and what the money come from. And so we were trying to sort out what was at the heart and what was at the periphery.
So his question was a summary of your discussion.
It was. And with a little wry humor, I mean, he was a person of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, but he also was saying, "Hey, in spite of all this, you and I know that deep down at the heart of the essence of the matter, this is this word spoken between I and thou, this word of salvation, this word of hope. I don't know where the levels of the economy come in, but a lot of stuff comes in to cloud that over, keeping us from getting back. That's why Holden has a great opportunity here to pull people off the internet for a few hours and their emails for a few hours to maybe ask some deeper questions about not only about life, but about the meaning of Jesus Christ. And maybe the whole question of the unity has to also involve a process that brings people back to the core, to the essence. And then you ask the question again. I mean, I'm getting personally to the point where, although I've worked so much in Africa and in Asia, that I don't value the denominations. So, I mean, I value what we hold to as Lutherans, but I like what Luther says. Don't call yourselves Lutherans. I mean, are we free enough to explore other configurations of unity? Unity is important. It helped us in Guatemala. I spent weeks in North Korea, and there are lots of churches there, lots of families, lots of homes. And there it's nice to be not a Catholic, a Lutheran, a Presbyterian, but a follower of Jesus Christ. And
did I hear you say there are churches in North Korea?
Yeah. There are lots of churches. Lots of churches. And lots of churches in homes, too, but there is something called the Korean Christian Federation in Pyongyang that seeks to control, I mean, everything's controlled. Everything's totally controlled. And even when somebody comes up to you and says, hey, I hate this damn government, I mean, you have to be very careful. Because you're just usually being baited by somebody from the government who wants you to fall and slip and make a mistake. So you have to be very, very careful. But believers, community of believers, by all means. Mainly Presbyterians and Catholics, you know. And it's a tough experience to...
Does that date from prior to the Korean War? Because I know the Presbyterian Church is very strong in South Korea, so are the roots of these churches from the earlier part of the 20th
sure.
century?
Absolutely.
And they survived? Huh?
They are. But of course the Korean War, I mean, we just destroyed all the churches. We bombed, saturation bombing of Pyongyang. And that was all the churches, all the neighborhoods, everything. And it was like yesterday it happened, if you go there. You see the billboards, and they have an image of Americans. Yeah?
So we have a session starting here at 8:30.
Okay.
Would it be possible? So I'm going to be talking about healing and some work I've done and some methods I've developed. But for those maybe that want to continue the conversation, could it just go in the library?
Yes, absolutely. Right. Sorry about that. Thank you, everybody.
Perfect time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.